Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Do you remember the early 80s? Most of the stars in the Broadway play This Is Our Youth weren't even born then, but they're playing characters living in New York in 1982. And the new music for this production is by Rustam Batmanglij from the band Vampire Weekend. He wasn't around in the early 80s either, but we'll hear some of what he came up with later on the show. Also in the early 80s, MTV began its reign over the airwaves, and in 1984, MTV decided to celebrate itself with a little coronation ceremony that they called the VMAs, the Video Music Awards. This weekend marks the 30th anniversary of the VMAs, and we'll take a look back. Now, if you were around and listening closely in the early 80s, you might have heard about this band out of England called Joy Division. You might even have heard this song. The song Transmission by Joy Division was not a hit. Love Will Tear Us Apart was their one and only hit. But this song contains within it the essence, the DNA of rock and roll. So says Greil Marcus, the dean of American rock critics and the author of a new book called The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs. Now, rather than picking over the well-worn stories of Elvis and Chuck Berry and the Rolling Stones, Greil has opted for a different tack, using individual songs like Transmission here to say something fundamental about the music of the past half century. Greil Marcus, welcome back to Soundcheck.
It's great to be with you.
You write about this Joy Division song, but I want to start with the first song that you write about in your book. It's Shake Some Action by the Flaming Groovies. What does this song say about rock and roll?
When I came up with this idea of a history of rock and roll in a handful of songs, I knew this would be the first one I would write about. This is a song that was recorded by a fairly obscure San Francisco band in 1972, wasn't even released until 1976. The band had high hopes. This was going to be their great breakthrough. They'd been together by the time it came out for 11 years. It went nowhere. They said it was supposed to fry Mick Jagger's brain, but probably he never even heard it. To me, it captures everything rock and roll has ever wanted to be. It is fast. It is urgent. It's full of despair and desire. It is tremendously exciting, and yet. It's both a victory and a defeat. But what really sealed it for me was that when I listened to this song, and I've listened to it countless times on the radio, playing it for myself, and I can never play it without playing it at least three times, is that before rock and roll, before Chuck Berry, before Elvis Presley, before Little Richard, no sound like the sound created in Shake Some Action had ever been heard on Earth. So Shake Some Action was my little nugget of proof that rock and roll actually was something new under the sun. Shake some action's what I need. So let me bust out at full speed. And I'm sure that's all you need. So make it all right.
of the Flamin' Groovies song Shake Some Action. Don't worry if you've never heard that before. Greil Marcus has written eloquently about it in his new book called The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs, and this is one of the 10, and as Greil has been telling us, sort of containing the world of rock and roll, the emotional contrasts and counterpoints within its 4.5 minutes. And Greil, one of the things you note about this song is we didn't hear the very beginning, but as the instruments come in, there's a kind of nervous energy, a kind of tension between what you expect the beat to be and where the guitarists especially are actually playing.
Right. It's as if they stepped in to this recording out of another song, as if they'd been, you know, as if they'd been carried on the ether of the radio, and were floating through space, and suddenly found themselves on a stage, and had to play in front of whoever was in the audience.
That song by the Flamin' Groovies, as you mentioned, Greil, it went nowhere at first, but except into some people's ears, the ears of listeners like you, whom it would resonate for many years.
Sure, their ears and their hearts.
And that seems to be one of the themes that runs through your list, is these songs keep coming back. They come back over the years, not always in the same form. In fact, that's part of the interesting thing about some of these songs, is the way they evolve as their songwriters perform them or as other people perform them.
Yeah, one of the things that began to fascinate me was the way in which any given song would be, as you say, taken up by other people or returned to many, many years later by the people who originally made them. And as these songs, you know, live their lives in the world, the people who created them kind of stand back and watch that with awe and wonder. One of the things that so struck me was the way that a song called Money Changes Everything began in 1978 as a punk single by a band called The Brains in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. It was taken up 5 years later by Cyndi Lauper for her first solo album, She's So Unusual, that enormous breakthrough album that had, I think, 5 singles in the top 10, one of which was her version of Money Changes Everything. And it's, you know, in the Brains version, it's a guy being left by his woman for somebody with more money, and he's standing there on the porch just, you know, in total hopelessness and humiliation and thinking about the terrible thing this woman has done to him. When Cyndi Lauper takes up the song, you'd expect her to simply reverse the gender and, you know, she'd be the victim and her man was walking away because he's found some rich girl. But she doesn't do that. She sings it as the woman leaving the man. The hell with you, you loser. I'm going for myself. And it becomes a song of just horrible vengeance and the destruction of values and God, for the Reagan years in 1983, it was just too perfect and too awful.
So it was rock and roll.
It was fabulous rock and roll.
Cyndi Lauper, Money Changes Everything, another of the 10 songs that kind of encapsulates the history of rock and roll. It's the subject of Greil Marcus's latest book, The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs. A somewhat misleading title, Greil, because every chapter on every song references dozens of other songs. I mean, I lost count of how many
songs there are in total, which are not just mentioned but kind of analyzed in the book.
Well, one reviewer counted and said there were 227. I didn't count. But, you know, every chapter does focus on a single song and the odyssey that the song makes through the years, inhabiting other bodies, coming out of other people's mouths.
Well, you know, one of the there are a couple of themes that appear. Money appears not just in Money Changes Everything, but also in the song Money, That's What I Want, which has hit the charts, I think, three times now, if you include the Flying Lizards version from the 1980s.
Right, and there are probably more, you know, we're both forgetting, but there was Barrett Strong who
did the original
in 1959, the Beatles' cataclysmic world-ending performance in 1963. The Flying Lizards, you know, in maybe around 1980, 1981. It's a song that people always come back to because it's just so stark. It's funny, but it's not funny. The best things in life are free, but you can keep them for the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
And that's real life. But what's scary about the song is that as Barrett Strong performs it, even more as the Beatles perform it, as John Lennon sings it, that's the whole of life in that song, and that's what's terrifying.
And one of the other themes that comes through in a lot of the songs is not just sadness, but crying. The verb to cry is kind of central to a couple of the songs that you've picked.
One of the things I'm looking for in this book stumbling on is just the extraordinary depth, the bottomlessness of so many songs, and particularly early soul records, records that weren't called soul at the time because the term hadn't come into use. But that's what they were. These are people, as they sing, they open themselves up to their own emotions in a way that can shake them and change them as they sing. And there's Etta James' All I Could Do Was Cry from 1959, and there's Buddy Holly's Crying, Waiting, Hoping that he recorded in his Greenwich Village apartment, just picking guitar and singing into his home tape recorder just a month before he died. And you
actually brought in that recording, the recording from his apartment.
Which is so extraordinary, both because, you know, you're hearing the voice of someone as if he's talking to you just before he dies, but also it's, you know, I don't know what kind of tape recorder he was using, but we feel like we're right there in his living room on Fifth Avenue near Washington Square Park.
This is Buddy Holly with Crying, Waiting, Hoping.
Crying, waiting, hoping you'll come back. I just can't seem to get you off my mind. Crying, waiting, hoping you'll come back. You're the one I love and I think about you all the time. Crying, my tears keep falling all night long, waiting. It feels so useless, I know it's wrong to keep a crying, waiting, hoping you'll come back. Maybe someday soon things will change and you'll be mine.
Buddy Holly recorded shortly before his death in his New York City apartment, Crying, Waiting, Hoping. Greil Marcus writes about that song in his new book, The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs. Clearly a demo tape. So what did they do? This is what they built the released song around?
Buddy Holly dies in a plane crash a month after he records this song. And his widow, Maria Elena Hawley, gives the tapes that he had been making in his apartment to his record company, and they bring in a band, they overdub, mm-hmm. They put it out as, you know, bring in female choruses, and they put it out. They put the stuff out. And in England, Crying, Waiting, Hoping is the flip side of Peggy Sue Got Married, which becomes a minor hit there, though it's not here. The Beatles hear it. This is 1959. And George Harrison falls in love with the song. And he learns the song, and they start playing it. Becomes part of their repertoire. And when they have their... And there's an overdubbed guitar solo that really isn't too terrible, and George is trying to learn that guitar solo. When they do their audition for Decca in 1962, that they so famously fail, mm-hmm. this is one of the demo songs that they record. And, you know, it's just in their blood, and it's a song they keep trying, they keep performing, they keep working on. When their career is done, 10 years after they first hear the song, 10 years after they first start playing it, they're making, they're in the midst of the Let It Be sessions in 1969. The band is falling to pieces. They hate each other. George, you know, will quit. Yoko's sitting there next to John. George feels he's no longer even in the band. Ringo quits. They come back. There's just an atmosphere of helplessness and despair. They're trying to make an album. They don't know what to do. And they play everything. They play everything they can think of. And one day, January 1969, they find themselves just playing Buddy Holly. And they do one song, and they do another song. And they're having fun with it. And there's a camaraderie. There's a sense of why they came together in the first place, why they love this music, which now is almost like poison to them. And they play one Buddy Holly song, they play another Buddy Holly song, and then there's a pause, and George hits a note on his guitar, and suddenly everybody there knows what the song is, and this is going to be the one they're going to have to get right, as they never had before. And they begin to slide into, to swim into, Crying, Waiting, Hoping. And there is just such joy and warmth, and they fool around with it as people always do with 50s rock and roll songs. They make fun of it, joking, smoking, and at one point John says, "You'll be mine," and they keep saying, "Maybe someday soon things will change and you'll be mine. Maybe you'll come back to me." They keep saying, "Maybe you'll come back to me." And that just echoes through the room because they are not coming back to each other, and they all know that. The song captures everything the Beatles ever were, the gift of joy that they gave to the world, but it captures it as absence, because it's gone, it's over, and they're never going to reach it again. So all that sense of longing, that sense of memory, that sense of commitment and belief, and untrammeled ambition, dreams realized, dreams dashed, it's all there in their recording of this song. When I first heard it, it was the most heartbreaking thing I'd ever heard, and still is.
Is that why the list skews so heavily to the 1950s? There are a couple of outliers, but most of these songs begin their journey in rock and roll in that decade.
Yeah, except in some cases it takes 50 years for a song to find its real singer. That's true in the case of To Know Him Is to Love Him, which is the last chapter in the book. That was starts in 1958 by the Teddy Bears. It's a kind of simpering, sentimental doo-wop song, Phil Spector's first record. He's one of the Teddy Bears. And it becomes a national hit, God knows why. It was really an embarrassment. And the radio wore it out very, very quickly. And I never would have written about this song, except as I was starting the book, I heard on the radio Amy Winehouse's version, which she had recorded in a London disc jockey studio in 2006. By the time I heard it, she was dead. And her death was a horror to me. She's such a great singer. She had so many lives to live just as a musician. And here is this, just her opening words. The opening line of the song is, to know him is to love him, and I do. The way she sings it, it's slow. It's dragged out. She lingers over the first two words, to know. A whole life and its dead end is already in that song, in those first two words. That song waited 50 years to find the person who could unlock it. There are all kinds of songs that are, you know, for much later, but what I found, what pulled me through this book was the lives songs led independently of their creators, independently of us. And that's why the table of contents lists various songs and different years when they appear in different guises, but no names of the people who recorded them.
Right. It is about not the singer, but the song. We've been speaking with Greil Marcus, the author of books like Mystery Train and Lipstick Traces and his latest, The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs. Greil, lots to ponder, lots to think about, and lots of people are going to be scurrying to YouTube to listen to some of these songs.
That's the place to go. Thank you so much.
Greil Marcus with us on Soundcheck.
To know him is to love him, and just to see him smile makes my life worthwhile. To know him is to love him, and I do.
That's Amy Winehouse's version of the song, To Know Him Is to Love Him, one of the songs that Greil Marcus writes about in his new book, The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs. You can find a full list of those songs at soundcheck.org. Up next, we'll talk with Vampire Weekend member Rustam Butmanglij about the music that he wrote for the new Broadway revival of This Is Our Youth. The play stars actors Michael Cera, Kieran Culkin, and Tavi Gevinson. That's coming up next on Soundcheck.
Anyway the wind blows is a fine with me.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you're familiar with Kenneth Lonergan's 1996 play, This Is Our Youth, you'll know that Frank Zappa's music pops up in the production from time to time, including this song. But in the new Broadway revival of This Is Our Youth, there's another artist whose music also plays an important role, and that is Rustam Butmanglij. The Vampire Weekend songwriter and multi-instrumentalist wrote some original music for this new production of This Is Our Youth, and Rostam's here with me in the Soundcheck studio. Hi, Rostam.
Good to be here.
So what was it about this play that first hooked you, that drew you in?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Kenny Lonergan. I really loved the movie Margaret. I think it's one of the best movies that's been made in the last decade. And anyone should see it if they get a chance, because it's a really special movie. And I was sent the script by the producers, Eli and Scott, and I read it in one sitting on an airplane. And when the plane landed, I said, I want to be part of this.
Wow.
Because I loved it.
Was Scott Rudin the
yes.
producer? Now, he's the guy who got James Murphy of LCD Sound System to mm-hmm. write music for another play that he had produced.
Yes.
So he seems to have, you know, his tentacles into the indie rock world to an extent.
I guess.
Yeah. And the idea was, I mean, there's this tradition in the theater of what they call entr'acte music. You know, it's mm-hmm. music at the beginning, music at the end, music between acts, mm-hmm. not actually in the scenes themselves. That seems to be what you've done here.
Yes. So the music that I wrote is sort of almost just kind of creating a mood, creating an atmosphere to set the stage for the play itself. And
so what is literally, I mean, for folks who haven't seen or don't know this, This Is Our Youth, just mm-hmm. thumbnail description, what is going on stage?
It's about two boys and one girl, and it takes place in an apartment on the Upper West Side in 1982. And their ages are 18 to 21. And it's just, I think, a very sort of realistic portrayal of kids that are somewhat up to no good.
Yeah. People who are lost and trying to find themselves in that weird place between teenagerdom and adulthood.
I don't know if they're even trying to find themselves.
Maybe I'm being a little generous.
They're trying to find something.
Yes, they are. And this edition of This Is Our Youth stars Michael Cera mm-hmm. as Warren, who's the kind of nerdy, nebbishy guy. Kieran Culkin as Dennis, who is the sort of spoiled rich kid. And Tavi Gevinson as Jessica. It opens on Thursday, the 11th, at the Court Theater. Now, we've got a string quartet here to play some of your music.
Yes.
This is just like a real short cue, this first thing, right?
Yeah, so this first thing is sort of what opens up the second act of the play. Coming out of the intermission, as you sit there in the theater, you witness sort of how night becomes day. And the set is really beautiful in this play, because it's a sort of life-size slice of New York, Upper West Side apartment building, and it's sort of like a cutaway that lets you see inside of it.
Everybody says it looks like their first apartment in New York. did you have that? Did you have that reaction?
Yeah.
With the the pipes and the view of the back of someone yeah. else's house, yeah.
My first and my last apartment.
We're speaking with Rostam Batmanglij. You may know his work with Vampire Weekend, but he's done the incidental music for the Broadway show This Is Our Youth, and this is music from the opening of Act Two. Short but sweet. That is music by my guest Rostam Batmanglij for the Broadway show This Is Our Youth, with Arthur Muller on violin, Feng Chunhui also playing violin, Mina Bassin on viola, and Hamilton Berry playing the cello. We'll hear something longer from them in just a couple of minutes. But so Rostam, there's a very classical sound. I mean, obviously it's a string quartet, but in the play itself, it's or two pianos.
And this piece has a little bit of strings, but is mostly just solo piano.
Yeah. So was that your first instrument?
No. My first instrument was the flute. And I don't know why I had a desire from a very young age to play flute. I think I was like 6 and maybe my hands were even too small to play it. So I started with the recorder. Then I studied the flute for about 7 years, and by the time I was a teenager, I never wanted to play a flute again. and I started taking guitar lessons, and along the way, I was kind of teaching myself piano through guitar, which was nice because it kind of it turned them into sort of one thing, which is, I think, when you study music, like that's sort of the goal, is to start to think of all instruments as one thing and all different kinds of music as like as one thing, and take you out of this the separatism.
Right, right. the tendency to like box everything up,
yeah,
and separate things out.
Yeah.
So you did.
So I didn't really study piano properly until I was about 18.
Yeah.
But so it was new for me.
You did study, I mean, at Columbia, you did study with a number of really pretty famous classical composers.
Yes.
People like Tristan Murray and Sebastian Currier and
yes.
stuff.
Yes. They were it was amazing to learn from them.
Yeah.
And one of the things I learned from Tristan Murray that stuck with me, and it's actually something you'll hear in this piece, is that he said that when five violins are playing in unison, it's actually quieter than just two violins playing in parallel thirds.
Hmm.
And there's like a certain power that happens as the overtones interact with each other. I hope we're not getting too technical.
For anyone who's ever heard any of Tristan Murai's music, you can hear that in it. You know, there's kind of a sparkle or a shimmer to the sound.
Exactly.
Which comes from the overtones, from knowing what to do with those overtones.
Yeah, so that was a great orchestration class. One of my favorite classes that I took with him.
So when you had the opportunity to write this music for This Is Our Youth, did you feel like you were using different musical muscles from what you do with Vampire Weekend?
Well, because I studied classical music, it's always kind of floating in my brain. And sometimes I call it to the fore, and other times I let it hang out in the background. But I think one of the biggest differences is that when the goal is to make a song, the drums are so crucial. And oftentimes, for me, the drums are the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, it wasn't so much about the drums.
Right. It is it is drumless music. Piano and strings for the most part. Rustam Batmanglij with me on soundcheck. The Broadway production of This Is Our Youth, starring Michael Cera and Kieran Culkin and Tavi Gevinson, opens on Thursday, although it's been in previews now for a bit, Thursday at the Court Theater. Now, let's play a little bit from tape here of some of the music from the end of Act 1. This extends through intermission,
yes,
right?
Yes, this is a 20-minute piece.
So is this ambient music, you know, to the extent that it's supposed to be a la Brian Eno, as ignorable as it is interesting?
The music that I wrote actually for the very beginning, for when people are taking their seats, it was ambient music. And I was actually influenced by Brian Eno and Arthur Russell. But then for this intermission... Mm-hmm.
Arthur Russell, the late cellist who was a part of the downtown New York scene and also a kind of post-disco performer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Arthur Russell was definitely one of those composers, songwriters who I think was very interested in like the oneness.
Yes.
Being the full spectrum, sort of. But so this piece is actually, I don't know, I've played it for some people and they say it sounds like jazz, but it also, it connects with like a lot of the more sort of Baroque classical musical themes that you hear in other parts of the play. So it has kind of those, hopefully it's kind of like at that intersection.
All right, let's hear a little bit. This is some of the music from Rustam Batmanglij from the end of Act 1 of the current Broadway production of Kenneth Lonergan's play, This Is Our Youth. A little bit of Rustam Batmanglij's music for intermission of the current Broadway production of This Is Our Youth, starring Michael Cera, Kieran Culkin, and Tavi Gevinson. with Incidental Music by Vampire Weekend's multi-instrumentalist, producer, and songwriter, Rostam Batmanglish. I mean, on the one hand, Rostam, I could see why some people would go to jazz because the drums have that kind of... But it, to me, it almost has the sound of, like, 60s film or TV music, in a sense. Now, there's a turntable on stage during the course of the play. It has a role to play. Is that why we're hearing, like, LP surface noise kind of mixed in there?
Yeah, I think that was... I think, you know, it just started to sound a little bit naked. And I did want to connect with the turntable that's such a big part of the play. So that was sort of the motive behind adding, sampling a turntable and adding that as ambience.
Well, now, you said before that when you're working on a song, you usually, you know, often start with the drums. Is that how that piece began?
No. No, actually, the drums were kind of the last thing. So that's... Okay. That's why it's not a song.
Right.
Maybe one day, though.
Well, now, is that, I mean, does that happen where you write things for another purpose and they end up turning into a song down the road?
Yeah, it does happen. And it's always kind of fun when you go and go through the archives and open something up and you're like, oh, whoa, I forgot that that became part of this Vampire Weekend song.
All right, so...
Months down the road, years down the road sometimes.
So Vampire Weekend fans with long memories who go to see this thing may at some point hear something familiar on a future project from Rostam Batmanglish. The play is set in 1982. How much, if at all, did that affect the sound of the music you wrote?
I think I was more specifically interested in place and my connection with the Upper West Side is a personal one because I lived there between ages 18 and 22 while I was going to college. Not actually the Upper West Side, Morningside Heights. Technically, they're different, but they're neighboring neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So I guess I just sort of reached back into my memories and thought about the music I was listening to, the music I was studying, just sort of the feelings that I had at that time of my life when I was living in that part of Manhattan. And that was sort of what got me to where I got with the music of the play.
What were you listening to during those years?
The Walkmen, one of my favorite bands of all time. Mm-hmm. Dirty Projectors, The Strokes. Those were all bands that I listened to a great deal throughout college.
And the last time you were on soundcheck was on stage at BAM with Hamilton Lighthouser of the Walkmen. You've done some work with him too.
Yeah, it was kind of a dream come true. As I said, when I listened to his music, you know, for years, and then just to sort of be able to reach out to him and say, "Hey, do you want to try and make some songs together?" And for it to happen was pretty special.
Yeah, and so. it happened, and it came out really well.
Yeah, thank you.
Soundcheck listeners, you can hear the results, the performance by Hamilton Lighthouser at the Brooklyn Academy of Music during Radio Love Fest from earlier this summer, and featuring Rostam Batmanglish is available on our website at soundcheck.org. But we've got the live string players here in the studio, so let's hear something. Now, this is from the opening of Act One, right?
Yes, and in fact, it's played by two pianos in the play, and you only hear about the first 30 seconds. But today we're going to hear the whole piece, which is about 2 minutes long.
So again, in the great tradition of film music, where a composer will write like 2 or 3 minutes and you hear 10 seconds in the movie, we get to hear the director's cut now of this piece.
Sure, yeah, so to speak.
Okay. The play is This Is Our Youth. The music's by Rostam Batmanglish.
Thank you.
A string quartet arrangement of some of Rostam Batmanglij's music for the current Broadway production of This Is Our Youth, the 1996 Kenneth Lonergan play, which is set in an apartment on the Upper West Side. And Rostam, you were saying before how you were inspired not so much by the time, 1982, but by the place, the Upper West Side of New York. The funny thing is, especially with that music from Act One, it's a very soft, it's a very quiet music, which most of us would not associate necessarily with New York at any period in time.
I guess I do. I mean, I guess I just have memories of going to practice rooms and being alone with an upright piano for several hours and sort of, I don't know, maybe being a sad teenager.
Or just being up really early in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Up early in the morning and up late at night.
The show opens officially on Thursday, the 11th, at the Court Theater. It's This Is Our Youth, starring Michael Cera, Kieran Culkin, and Tavi Gevinson. So it's an all-star cast with incidental music by my guest, Rostam Batmanglij. Rostam, great to see you again. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Up next, the inaugural MTV Video Music Awards took place 30 years ago this weekend. We'll take a look back with Rob Tannenbaum, author of the book I Want My MTV, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video Revolution. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The MTV Video Music Awards, the VMAs, took place last month, and the big story was Beyoncé's extended performance of songs from her self-titled latest album. But this month marks the 30th anniversary of the very first MTV VMAs. They took place here in New York on September 14th of 1984. Rob Tannenbaum wrote about that inaugural show in his book, I Want My MTV, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video Revolution. And Rob joins us here in our Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
So 1984, take us back to what the awards situation. I mean, I turn on the TV and it's like every week there's another award ceremony going on. It wasn't quite the glut of awards we had back then.
It wasn't, although MTV did begin to add to it. By 1984, they were in their third year, and they had really started out by breaking all of the usual TV conventions, frankly, including professionalism. They took great pride in the fact that you would turn it on, and it might look like local access cable TV. But after about 3 years, once they realized they were starting to acquire some power, they wanted to have what we would now call a tentpole. Mm-hmm. A show that they could put on every year. And it's really very clever what they came up with. The Emmys celebrate television. The Grammys celebrate music. The Video Music Awards celebrate MTV. Mm. It's a display of their power, their influence, and their taste for outrage, which started right off the bat in 84.
You are talking, of course, about Madonna.
Yes.
You know, I just watched that video again. It is online, of course. And, you know, it seems a little risque now. You know, she's dressed in a bridal gown.
What, white virginal wedding gown, huh?
Yeah.
As she's rolling around on the floor.
Right. So by the end of her performance, we get a good look at the stockings and garters underneath. And it must have been, I mean, would it have been outrageous for the people who were watching MTV at that time?
Yes, it was. You do get to see all of her attributes. You even hear a little bit of her voice because, you know, that's important too. There were people, when I wrote the book, I interviewed, my co-author and I interviewed hundreds of people. But Madonna's publicist told us that after that incident, the episode, people came up to her and said, "Your artist's career is over."
Well, apparently her own manager, Freddie DeMann, told her that when she got off the stage. What have you done?
Freddie was not sure it was a great idea, but Madonna was sure. And this is one of the things that strikes me about the 84 VMAs. If you watch it on YouTube, which you can do in bits and pieces, the whole thing was a mess. It really was a sort of amateurish production. The co-hosts were the wrong people. The bands weren't entirely sure what to say, making their acceptance speeches. The only person who knew what to do that night was Madonna.
And she did it with this song called "Like a Virgin." Madonna singing live while stepping down out of this 10-foot-high wedding cake, I guess.
17 feet of wedding cake.
17 feet high. Mm-hmm. And then making her way to the stage floor where she would eventually roll around and...
As brides do.
Yeah, right. you know, taking off parts of, you know, the veil and stuff and straddling it. And yeah, it was a pretty big, bold move for her. Where was she in her career at this point?
She had just finished promoting her first record. MTV, and this is a thing that happens over and over again at the VMAs in years to come. MTV wanted her to sing a hit. She didn't want to sing a hit because she felt that she had moved on in her career. She was recording with Nile Rodgers, who produced Like a Virgin, and she wanted to debut her song at the VMAs.
So this is the first time people are hearing this song.
I believe so. It certainly was the first time she had performed it in public.
Yeah. We're speaking with Rob Tannenbaum, co-author of the book I Want My MTV, and we're talking with Rob because this Sunday is the 30th anniversary of the first MTV Video Music Awards back in 84. Was there any concern that MTV, this still-fledgling network, wouldn't be able to pull off this major award show?
This was a really huge undertaking for them. It was the most ambitious thing they'd ever done, and they needed for it to succeed.
Well, it seems like it had to succeed when you have... I mean, of course, they didn't know in advance what Madonna was going to do, but still, you know, they had Madonna, who was clearly a rising star, a fast-rising comet in the pop scene, and they had Michael Jackson's Thriller, which had become a kind of cultural phenomenon through MTV. And that was up for all of the major awards, too.
The Thriller videos really saved MTV, which is hilarious in retrospect because they weren't enthusiastic about playing artists of color. But MTV was probably 3 or 4 months away from bankruptcy and failure when the Thriller videos caught fire and the ratings shot up and saved the network. But... Thriller is not the biggest video of the 1984 VMAs. In terms of victories, mm-hmm. the biggest artist of the night was a middle-aged progressive jazz pianist who had made a record with synthesizers and turntables, which in 1984 not many people were doing.
You're talking, of course, about Herbie Hancock.
Right.
And the song Rocket, which even today, you look at that video and it was pretty ahead of its time.
It was directed by Godley and Cream.
The founders of the English band 10cc back in the 70s.
When I did interviews for the book, people kept asking me what my favorite video was. And I gave different answers. A lot of times I said this was my favorite video, and certainly Godley and Cream were the best directors in the first stage of MTV. It's robots
right.
flying all around the room, kicking the legs, stuttering. It's so advanced that I think you could show it to an audience today and they would be impressed.
And all of that, the robot limbs in motion are synced, of course,
yeah.
to the song, which is called Rocket. Was a hit for Herbie Hancock.
Herbie Hancock had a top 40 song and a video that was all over MTV.
The jazz pianist who was well beyond the target age of the MTV audience. The song is Rocket. It's still a great video, and it was the big winner that night, September 14th, 1984, the first MTV VMAs, Video Music Awards. Celebrating the 30th anniversary this weekend, and Rob Tannenbaum's with me on Soundcheck, co-author of the book I Want My MTV, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video Revolution. So Rocket is the big winner that first night, 5 awards.
Yep.
Second place goes to Thriller, somewhat surprisingly, in view of how historic and important Thriller was.
Definitely.
Only gets 3 awards, and yet neither of these musical juggernauts walks off with the big award.
It happens from time to time. Obviously, this was the first year it happened because it was the first year anything happened. but the video of the year was You Might Think by The Cars, which is one of those 80s artifacts that if you look at it now, you kind of snicker.
Yeah.
The technology it used at the time, it might have been some green screen or blue screen. It's just so much more sophisticated now. But at the time, whoa, nobody had ever seen anything like that in a music video.
So as I recall, this is Rick Ocasek was dating Paulina Porizkova, the model.
Before they were married.
Right. And so she is in the video kind of as a small, almost bird or bug-like thing flying around.
Right.
And so this was considered, like, really advanced technologically back then.
It was, and Ocasek hated this video. Like a lot of rock stars, he didn't enjoy being in front of the camera, and the video made use of how, let's say, unusual looking he is.
Yeah.
He didn't enjoy that. Who would? He's a little bit freakish in the video.
And this was, like, even by Thriller standards, an expensive video to make.
It was. We have Michael Jackson to thank for this, because in the early days, record companies didn't want to invest in videos. They didn't see that they would get any kind of a return on it. I think Michael was the first person to ever spend 6 figures on a video, certainly the first person to spend 7 figures on a video. Mm. And once he raised the game and showed that videos were an investment that had a you know, multiple return, then record companies started throwing money at videos, and they got more sophisticated.
They threw a lot at the video for this song. You can see the video at soundcheck.org, but here's the song that won the big award at the first VMAs from The Cars.
You might think it's hysterical.
The
30th anniversary of the very first Video Music Awards is this Sunday, September 14th, and we've been looking back with Rob Tannenbaum, co-author of the book I Want My MTV, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video Revolution. Rob, nice talking to you.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
Kept it going till the sun fell down. You kept it going.
We've recently been asking you all to send in your questions for a series we're calling Ask John Schaefer Anything About Music. Well, for all of you who will be sitting in front of a computer tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. Eastern, join me on the web community site Reddit, where I'll be doing an AMA, or Ask Me Anything. I'll be answering your questions, as long as they have something to do with music. That's happening tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Make sure that you're following us on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll send you a link right to the page where it's all happening. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we'll hear about a new book called Another Side of Bob Dylan. It was written by the late Victor Maimoudis, Bob Dylan's road manager and confidant for many years. Plus, in the midst of Kate Bush's 22-show run in London, we get the essentials on the English singer-songwriter, who recently had 8 albums in the UK Top 40 charts at once. And the British duo Smoke Fairies makes dreamy pop that draws on folk and blues. Add their exquisite harmonies and an aura of mystery, and you have a can't-miss session in the Soundcheck studio. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.